Arthur started with horror and fear, first at what he appeared to have done, and then at the loud sirens and bells that suddenly shattered the air to announce some clamouring emergency. He stared wildly around him. The only exit appeared to be the way he had come in. He pelted toward it, throwing away the nasty fake leopard-skin bag as he did so. He dashed randomly, haphazardly through the labyrinthine maze. He seemed to be pursued more and more fiercely by klaxons, sirens, flashing lights. Suddenly he turned a corner, and there was a light in front of him. It wasn't flashing. It was daylight. Chapter 19. Although it has been said that on Earth alone in our galaxy is cricket treated as a fit subject for a game, and that for this reason the Earth has been shunned, this only applies to our galaxy, and more specifically to our dimension. In some of the higher dimensions, they feel they can more or less please themselves. And they have been playing a peculiar game called Brockian Ultra Cricket for whatever their transdimensional equivalent of billions of years is. Let's be blunt. It's a nasty game, says the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But then, anyone who's been to any of the higher dimensions will know that they're a pretty nasty heathen lot up there who should just be smashed and done in, and would be too if anyone could work out a way of firing missiles at right angles to reality. This is another example of the fact that the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy will employ anybody who wants to walk straight in off the street and get ripped off, especially if they happen to walk in off the street during the afternoon when very few of the regular staff members are there. There is a fundamental point here. The history of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is one of idealism, struggle, despair, passion, success, failure, and enormously long lunch breaks. The earliest origins of the guide are now, along with most of its financial records, lost in the mists of time. For other and more curious theories about where they are lost, see below. Most of the surviving stories, however, speak of a founding editor called Herling Frutmig. Herling Frutmig, it is said, founded the guide, established its fundamental principles of honesty and idealism, and went bust. There followed many years of penury and heart-searching, during which he consulted friends, sat in darkened rooms in illegal states of mind, thought about this and that, fooled about with weights, and then, after a chance encounter with the holy lunching friars of Vundun, who claimed that just as lunch was at the centre of a man's temporal day, and man's temporal day could be seen as an analogy for his spiritual life, so lunch should be A, seen as the centre of man's spiritual life, and B, held in jolly nice restaurants, he refounded the guide, laid down its fundamental principles of honesty and idealism and where you could stuff them both, and led the guide on to its first major commercial success. He also started to develop and explore the role of the editorial lunch break that was subsequently to play such a crucial part in the guide's history, since it meant that most of the actual work got done by any passing stranger who happened to wander into the empty offices of an afternoon and saw something worth doing. Shortly after this, the guide was taken over by Mega Dodo Publications of Ursa Minor Beta, thus putting the whole thing on a very sound financial footing, and allowing the fourth editor, Lig Lurie Jr., to embark on lunch breaks of such breathtaking scope that even the efforts of recent editors, who started undertaking sponsored lunch breaks for charity, seem like mere sandwiches in comparison. In fact, Lig never formally resigned his editorship. He merely left his office late one morning and has never since returned. Though well over a century has now passed, many members of the guide staff still retain the romantic notion that he has simply popped out for a ham croissant and will yet return to put in a solid afternoon's work. Strictly speaking, all editors since Lig Lurie Jr. have therefore been designated acting editors, and Lig's desk is still preserved the way he left it, with the addition of a small sign that says, Lig Lurie Jr., editor, missing, presumed fed. Some very scurrilous and subversive sources hint at the idea that Lig actually perished in the guide's first extraordinary experiments in alternative bookkeeping. Very little is known of this, and still less said. Anyone who even notices, let alone calls attention to the curious but utterly coincidental and meaningless fact that every world on which the guide has ever set up an accounting department has shortly afterwards perished in warfare or some natural disaster, is liable to get sued to smithereens. It is an interesting, though utterly unrelated, fact that the 2 or 3 days prior to the demolition of the planet Earth to make way for a new hyperspace bypass saw a dramatic upsurge in the number of UFO sightings there, not only above Lord's Cricket Ground and St John's Wood, London, but also above Glastonbury and Somerset. Glastonbury had long been associated with myths of ancient kings, witchcraft and wart-curing, and had now been selected as the site of the guide's new financial records office, and indeed 10 years' worth of financial records were transferred to a magic hill just outside the city, mere hours before the Vogons arrived. None of these facts, however strange or inexplicable, is as strange or inexplicable as the rules of the game of Brockian ultra cricket, as played in the higher dimensions. A full set of rules is so massively complicated that the only time they were all bound together in a single volume, they underwent gravitational collapse and became a black hole. A brief summary, however, follows. Rule 1. Grow at least 3 extra legs. You won't need them, but it keeps the crowds amused. Rule 2. Find 1 extremely good Brockian ultra cricket player. Clone him off a few times. This saves an enormous amount of tedious selection and training. Rule 3. Put your team and the opposing team in a large field and build a high wall around them. The reason for this is that though the game is a major spectator sport, the frustration experienced by the audience at not actually being able to see what's going on leads them to imagine that it's a lot more exciting than it really is. A crowd that has just watched a rather humdrum game experiences far less life affirmation than a crowd that believes it has just missed the most dramatic event in sporting history. Rule 4. Throw lots of assorted items of sporting equipment over the wall for the players. Anything will do. Cricket bats, base cube bats, tennis guns, skis, anything you can get a good swing with. Rule 5. The players should now lay about themselves for all they're worth with whatever they find to hand. Whenever a player scores a hit on another player, he should immediately run away as fast as he can and apologise from a safe distance. Apologies should be concise, sincere, and for maximum clarity and points, delivered through a megaphone. Rule 6. The winning team shall be the first team that wins. Curiously enough, the more the obsession with the game grows in the higher dimensions, the less it is actually played, since most of the competing teams are now in a state of permanent warfare with each other over the interpretation of these rules. This is all for the best, because in the long run, a good solid war is less psychologically damaging than a protracted game of Brockian ultra cricket. Chapter 20. As Arthur ran, darting, dashing and panting down the side of the mountain, he suddenly felt the whole bulk of the mountain move very, very slightly beneath him. There was a rumble, a roar, and a slight blurred movement, and a lick of heat in the distance behind and above him. He ran in a frenzy of fear. The land began to slide, and he suddenly felt the force of the word landslide in a way that had never been apparent to him before. It had always just been a word to him, but now he was suddenly and horribly aware that sliding is a strange and sickening thing for land to do. It was doing it with him on it. He felt ill with fear and trembling. The ground slid, the mountain slurred. He slipped, he fell, he stood, he slipped again and ran. The avalanche began. Stones, then rocks, then boulders pranced past him like clumsy puppies, only much bigger, much, much harder and heavier, and almost infinitely more likely to kill you if they fell on you. His eyes danced with them, his feet danced with the dancing ground, he ran as if running were a terrible sweating sickness, his heart pounded to the rhythm of the pounding geological frenzy around him. The logic of the situation, i.e. that he was clearly bound to survive if the next foreshadowed incident in the saga of his inadvertent persecution of Agrajag was to happen, was utterly failing to impinge itself on his mind or exercise any restraining influence on him at this time. He ran with the fear of death in him, under him, over him, and grabbing hold of his hair. And suddenly he tripped again and was hurled forward by his considerable momentum. But just at the moment he was about to hit the ground astoundingly hard, he saw lying directly in front of him a small navy blue holdall that he knew for a fact he had lost in the baggage retrieval system at Athens Airport some 10 years previously in his personal timescale, and in his astonishment he missed the ground completely and bobbed off into the air with his brain singing. What he was doing was this. He was flying. He glanced around him in surprise, but there could be no doubt that that was what he was doing. No part of him was touching the ground, and no part of him was even approaching it. He was simply floating there with boulders hurtling through the air around him. He could now do something about that, blinking with the non-effort of it. He wafted higher into the air, and now the boulders were hurtling through the air beneath him. He looked downward with intense curiosity. Between him and the shivering ground were now some 30 feet of empty air. Empty, that is, if you discounted the boulders that didn't stay in it for long, but bounded on downward in the iron grip of the law of gravity. The same law that seemed all of a sudden to have given Arthur a sabbatical. It occurred to him almost instantly, with the instinctive correctness that self-preservation instills in the mind, that he mustn't try to think about it, that if he did, the law of gravity would suddenly glance sharply in his direction and demand to know what the hell he thought he was doing up there, and all would suddenly be lost. So he thought about tulips, It was difficult, but he did. He thought about the pleasing firm roundness of the bottom of tulips. He thought about the interesting variety of colours they came in and wondered what proportion of the total number of tulips that grew or had grown on the earth would be found within a radius of 1 mile from a windmill. After a while, he got dangerously bored of this train of thought. Felt the air slipping away beneath him, felt that he was drifting down into the paths of the bouncing boulders that he was trying so hard not to think about. So he thought about Athens Airport for a bit, and that kept him usefully annoyed for about 5 minutes, at the end of which he was startled to discover that he was now floating about 600 feet above the ground. He wondered for a moment how he was going to get back down to it, but instantly shied away from that area of speculation again and tried to look at the situation steadily. He was flying. What was he going to do about it? He looked back down at the ground. He didn't look at it hard, but did his best just to give it an idle glance, as it were, in passing. There were a couple of things he couldn't help noticing. One was that the eruption of the mountain seemed now to have spent itself. There was a crater just a little way beneath the peak, presumably where the rock had caved in on top of the huge, cavernous cathedral, the statue of himself and the sadly abused figure of Agrajag. The other was his holdall. The one he'd lost at Athens Airport. It was sitting pertly on a piece of clear ground, surrounded by exhausted boulders, but apparently hit by none of them. Why this should be, he could not speculate, but since this mystery was completely overshadowed by the monstrous impossibility of the bags being there in the first place, it was not a speculation he really felt strong enough for anyway. The thing is, it was there, and the nasty fake leopardskin bag seemed to have disappeared, which was all to the good, if not entirely to the explicable. He was faced with the fact that he was going to have to pick the thing up. Here he was, flying along 600 feet above the surface of an alien planet, the name of which he couldn't even remember. He could not ignore the plaintive posture of this tiny piece of what used to be his life, here, so many light years from the pulverized remains of his home. Furthermore, he realized the bag, if it was still in the same state in which he'd lost it, would contain a can that would have in it the only Greek olive oil still surviving in the universe. Slowly, carefully, inch by inch, he began to bob downward, swinging gently from side to side like a nervous sheet of paper, feeling its way toward the ground. It went well. He was feeling good. The air supported him, but let him through. 2 minutes later, he was hovering a mere 2 feet above the bag and was faced with some difficult decisions. He bobbed there lightly. He frowned, but again as lightly as he could. If he picked the bag up, could he carry it? Wouldn't the extra weight pull him straight to the ground? Wouldn't the mere act of touching something on the ground suddenly discharge whatever mysterious force it was that was holding him in the air? Wouldn't he be better off just being sensible at this point and stepping out of the air back onto the ground for a moment or two? If he did, would he ever be able to fly again? The sensation when he allowed himself to be aware of it was so quietly ecstatic that he could not bear the thought of losing it, perhaps forever. With this in mind, he bobbed upward a little, just to try the feel of it, the surprise and effortless movement of it. He bobbed, he floated, he tried a little swoop. The swoop was terrific. With his arms spread out in front of him, his hair and his dressing gown streaming out behind him, he dived down out of the sky, bellied along a body of air about 2 feet from the ground, and swung back up again, catching himself at the top of the swing and holding, just holding. He stayed there. It was wonderful. And that, he realized, was the way to pick up the bag. He would swoop down and catch hold of it just at the moment of the upswing. He would carry it on up with him. He might wobble a bit, but he was certain that he could hold it. He tried one or two more practice swoops, and they got better and better. The air on his face, the bounce and woof of his body, all combined to make him feel an intoxication of the spirit that he hadn't felt since he was born. He drifted away on the breeze and surveyed the countryside, which was, he discovered, pretty nasty. It had a wasted, ravaged look. He decided not to look at it anymore. He would just pick up the bag and then... He didn't know what he was going to do after he picked up the bag. He decided he would just pick up the bag and see where things went from there. He judged himself against the wind, pushed up against it, and turned around. He floated on its body. He didn't realize it, but his body was Willamying at this point. He ducked down under the airstream, dipped, and dived. The air threw itself past him. He thrilled through it. The ground wobbled uncertainly, straightened its ideas out, and rose smoothly up to meet him, offering the bag, its cracked plastic handles up towards him. Halfway down, there was a sudden dangerous moment when he could no longer believe he was doing this, and therefore very nearly wasn't. but he recovered himself in time, skimmed over the ground, slipped an arm smoothly through the handles of the bag, and began to climb back up again. Couldn't make it, and all of a sudden collapsed, bruised, scratched and shaking on the stony ground. He staggered instantly to his feet, swayed hopelessly around, swinging the bag around him in an agony of grief and disappointment. His feet suddenly were stuck heavily to the ground in the way they always had been. His body seemed like an unwieldy sack of potatoes that reeled, stumbling against the ground. His mind had all the lightness of a bag of lead. He sagged and swayed and ached with giddiness. He tried hopelessly to run, but his legs were suddenly too weak. He tripped and flopped forward. At that moment, he remembered that in the bag he was now carrying was not only a can of Greek olive oil, but a duty-free allowance of Retsina. And in the pleasurable shock of that realization, he failed to notice for at least 10 seconds that he was now flying again. He whooped and cried with relief and pleasure and sheer physical delight. He swooped, he wheeled, he skidded and whirled through the air. Cheekily, he sat on an updraft and went through the contents of the holdall. He felt the way he imagined an angel must feel doing its celebrated dance on the head of a pin while being counted by philosophers. He laughed with pleasure at the discovery that the bag did in fact contain the olive oil and the Retsina, as well as a pair of cracked sunglasses, some sand-filled swimming trunks, some creased postcards of Santorini, a large and unsightly towel, some interesting stones, and various scraps of paper with the addresses of people he was relieved to think he would never meet again, even if the reason why was a sad one. He dropped the stones, put on the sunglasses, and let the pieces of paper whip away in the wind. 10 minutes later, drifting idly through a cloud, he got a large and extremely disreputable cocktail party in the small of the back. Chapter 21. The longest and most destructive party ever held is now into its fourth generation, and still no one shows any signs of leaving. Someone did once look at his watch, but that was 11 years ago now, and there has been no follow-up. The mess is extraordinary and has to be seen to be believed, but if you don't have any particular need to believe it, then don't go and look, because you won't enjoy it. There have recently been some bangs and flashes up in the clouds, and there is one theory that this is a battle being fought between the fleets of several rival carpet-cleaning companies who are hovering over the thing like vultures, but you shouldn't believe anything you hear at parties, and particularly not anything you hear at this one. One of the problems, and it's one that's obviously going to get worse, is that all the people at the party are either the children or the grandchildren or the great-grandchildren of the people who wouldn't leave in the first place. And because of all the business about selective breeding and recessive genes and so on, it means that all the people now at the party are either absolutely fanatical partygoers or gibbering idiots, or, more and more frequently, both. Either way, it means that, genetically speaking, each succeeding generation is now less likely to leave than the preceding one. So other factors come into operation, like when the drinks are going to run out. Now, because of certain things that have happened that seemed like a good idea at the time, and one of the problems of the party that never stops, is that all the things that only seem like a good idea at parties continue to seem like good ideas, that point seems still to be a long way off. One of the things that seemed like a good idea at the time was that the party should fly. Not in the normal sense that parties are meant to fly, but literally. One night, long ago, a band of drunken astro-engineers of the first generation clambered around the building, digging this, fixing that, banging very hard on the other, and when the sun rose the following morning, it was startled to find itself shining on a building full of happy, drunken people that was now floating like a young and uncertain bird over the treetops. Not only that, but the flying party had also managed to arm itself rather heavily. If they were going to get involved in any petty arguments with wine merchants, they wanted to make sure they had might on their side. The transition from full-time cocktail party to part-time raiding party came with ease, and did much to add that extra bit of zest and swing to the whole affair that was badly needed at this point because of the enormous number of times that the band had already played all the numbers it knew over the years. They looted, they raided, they held whole cities to ransom for fresh supplies of cheese crackers, guacamole, spare ribs, and wine and spirits that would now get piped aboard from floating tankers. The problem of when the drinks are going to run out is, however, going to have to be faced one day. The planet over which they are floating is no longer the planet it was when they first started floating over it. It is in bad shape. The party has attacked and raided an awful lot of it, and no one has ever succeeded in hitting it back because of the erratic and unpredictable way in which it lurches around the sky. It is one hell of a party. It is also one hell of a thing to get hit by in the small of the back. Chapter 22. Arthur lay floundering in pain on a piece of ripped and dismembered reinforced concrete, flicked at by wisps of passing cloud and confused by the sounds of flabby merrymaking somewhere indistinctly behind him. There was a sound he couldn't immediately identify, partly because he didn't know the tune I Left My Leg in Jaglan Beta, and partly because the band playing it was very tired, and some members of it were playing in 3/4 time, some in 4/4, and some in a kind of pie-eyed pie-r-squared, each according to the amount of sleep he'd managed to grab recently. He lay panting heavily in the wet air and tried feeling bits of himself to see where he might be hurt. Wherever he touched himself, he encountered a pain. After a short while, he worked out that this was because it was his hand that was hurting. He seemed to have sprained his wrist. His back, too, was hurting, but he soon satisfied himself that he was not badly hurt, but just bruised and a little shaken, as who wouldn't be. He couldn't understand what a building would be doing flying through the clouds. On the other hand, he would have been a little hard-pressed to come up with any convincing explanation of his own presence, so he decided that he and the building were just going to have to accept each other. He looked up from where he was lying. A wall of pale but stained stone slabs rose up behind him, the building proper. He seemed to be stretched out on some sort of ledge or lip that extended outward for about 3 or 4 feet all the way around. It was a hunk of the ground in which the party building had had its foundations, and which it had taken along with itself to keep itself bound together at the bottom end. Nervously he stood up, and suddenly, looking out over the edge, he felt nauseous with vertigo. He pressed himself back against the wall, wet with mist and sweat. His head was swimming freestyle, but his stomach was doing the butterfly. Even though he had got up here under his own power, he could now not even bear to contemplate the hideous drop in front of him. He was not about to try his luck jumping. He was not about to move an inch closer to the edge. Clutching his holdall, he edged along the wall, hoping to find a doorway in. The solid weight of the can of olive oil was a great reassurance to him. He was edging in the direction of the nearest corner, in the hope that the wall around the corner might offer more in the way of entrances than this one, which offered none. The unsteadiness of the building's flight made him feel sick with fear, and after a short time he took the towel from out of his bag and did something with it, which once again justified its supreme position in the list of useful things to take with you when you hitchhike round the galaxy. He put it over his head so he wouldn't have to see what he was doing. His feet edged along the ground. His outstretched hand edged along the wall. Finally he came to the corner, and as his hand rounded the corner, it encountered something that gave him such a shock he nearly fell off. It was another hand. The two hands gripped each other. He desperately wanted to use his other hand to pull the towel away from his eyes, but it was holding the bag with the olive oil, the retsina, and the postcards of Santorini, and he very much didn't want to put it down. He experienced one of those self moments, one of those moments when you suddenly turn around and look at yourself and think, "Who am I? What am I up to? What have I achieved? Am I doing well?" He whimpered very slightly. He tried to free his hand, but he couldn't. The other hand was holding his tightly. He had no recourse but to edge onward toward the corner. He leaned around it and shook his head in an attempt to dislodge the towel. This seemed to provoke a sharp cry of some unfathomable emotion from the owner of the other hand. The towel was whipped from his head, and he found his eyes peering into those of Ford Prefect. Beyond him stood Slutty Bartfast, and beyond them he could clearly see a porchway and a large closed door. They were both pressed back against the wall, eyes wild with terror, as they stared out into the thick, blind cloud around them, and tried to resist the lurching and swaying of the building. "Where the zarking photon have you been?" hissed Ford, panic-stricken. Well, stuttered Arthur, not really knowing how to sum it all up that briefly. Here and there. What are you doing here? Ford turned his wild eyes on Arthur again. "They won't let us in without a bottle," he hissed. The first thing Arthur noticed as they entered into the thick of the party, apart from the noise, the suffocating heat, the wild profusion of colours that protruded dimly through the atmosphere of heady smoke, the carpets thick with ground glass, ash and guacamole droppings, and the small group of pterodactyl-like creatures in lurex who descended on his cherished bottle of Retsina, squawking, "A new pleasure, a new pleasure," was Trillian being chattered up by a thunder god. "Didn't I see you at Millie Way's?" he was saying. "Were you the one with the hammer?" "Yes, I much prefer it here, so much less reputable, so much more fraught." Squeals of some hideous pleasure ran around the room, the outer dimensions of which were invisible through the heaving throng of happy, noisy creatures, cheerfully yelling things that nobody could hear at each other, and occasionally having crises. "Seems fun," said Trillian. "What did you say, Arthur?" I said, how the hell did you get here? I was a row of dots flowing randomly through the universe. Have you met Thor? He makes thunder. Hello, said Arthur. I expect that must be very interesting. Hi, said Thor. It is. Have you got a drink? No, actually. Then why don't you go and get one? See you later, Arthur, said Trillian. Something jogged Arthur's mind, and he looked round huntedly. Seyfod isn't here, is he? See you, said Trillian firmly, later. Thor glared at him with hard, coal-black eyes, his beard bristling. What little light there was in the place mustered its forces briefly to glint menacingly off the horns on his helmet. He took Trillian's elbow in his extremely large hand, and the muscles in his upper arm moved around each other like a couple of Volkswagens parking. He led her away. One of the interesting things about being immortal, he said, is... One of the interesting things about space, Arthur heard Slarty Bartfast saying to a large and voluminous creature who looked like someone losing a fight with a pink duvet and was gazing raptly at the old man's deep eyes and silver beard, is how dull it is. Dull? Said the creature, and blinked her rather wrinkled and bloodshot eyes. Yes, said Slarty Bartfast, staggeringly dull, bewilderingly so. You see, there's so much of it and so little in it. Would you like me to quote you some of the statistics? Well... Please, I would like to. They, too, are quite sensationally dull. I'll come back and hear them in a moment, she said, patted him on the arm, lifted up her skirts like a hovercraft, and moved off into the heaving crowd. I thought she'd never go, growled the old man. Come, Earthman. Arthur. We must find the silver bale. It is here somewhere. Can't we just relax a little, Arthur said. I've had a tough day. Trillian's here, incidentally. She didn't say how. It probably doesn't matter. Think of the danger to the universe. The universe, said Arthur, is big enough and old enough to look after itself for half an hour. Oh, right, he added in response to Slarty Bartfast's increasing agitation. I'll wander around and see if anybody's seen it. Good, good, said Slarty Bartfast, good. He plunged into the crowd himself and was told to relax by everybody he passed. Have you seen a bale anywhere? Said Arthur to a little man who seemed to be standing eagerly waiting to listen to somebody. It's made of silver, vitally important for the future safety of the universe, and about this long. No, said the enthusiastically wizened little man, but do have a drink and tell me all about it. Ford Prefect writhed past, dancing a wild, frenetic and not entirely unobscene dance with someone who looked as if she was wearing Sydney Opera House on her head. He was yelling a futile conversation at her above the din. I like the hat, he bawled. What? I said I like the hat. I'm not wearing a hat. Well, I like the head, then. What? I said I like the head. Interesting bone structure. What? Ford worked a shrug into the complex routine of other movements he was performing. I said you dance great, he shouted. Just don't nod so much. What? It's just that every time you nod, said Ford, ow! He added as his partner nodded forward to say what, and once again pecked him sharply on the forehead with the sharp end of her swept forward skull. My planet was blown up one morning, said Arthur, who had found himself quite unexpectedly telling the little man his life story, or at least edited highlights of it. That's why I'm dressed like this, in my dressing gown. My planet was blown up with all my clothes in it, you see. I didn't realize I'd be coming to a party. The man nodded enthusiastically. Later I was thrown off a spaceship, still in my dressing gown, rather than the spacesuit one would normally expect. Shortly after that, I discovered that my planet had originally been built for a bunch of mice. You can imagine how I felt about that. I was then shot at for a while and blown up. In fact, I've been blown up ridiculously often, shot at, insulted, regularly disintegrated, deprived of tea, and recently I crashed into a swamp and had to spend 5 years in a damp cave. Ah, effervesced the little man. And did you have a wonderful time? Arthur started to choke violently on his drink. What a wonderfully exciting cough, said the little man, quite startled by it. Do you mind if I join in? And with that, he launched into the most extraordinary and spectacular fit of coughing that caught Arthur so much by surprise that he started to choke violently, discovered that he was already doing it, and got thoroughly confused. Together they performed a lung-busting duet that went on for fully 2 minutes before Arthur managed to cough and splutter to a halt. So invigorating, said the little man, panting and wiping tears from his eyes. What an exciting life you must lead. Thank you very much. He shook Arthur warmly by the hand and walked off into the crowd. Arthur shook his head in astonishment. A youngish-looking man came up to him, an aggressive-looking type with a hook mouth, a lantern nose, and small beady little cheekbones. He was wearing black trousers, a black silk shirt open to what was presumably his navel, though Arthur had learnt never to make assumptions about the anatomies of the sort of people he tended to meet these days, and had all sorts of nasty, dangly gold things hanging round his neck. He carried something in a black bag, and clearly wanted people to notice that he didn't want them to notice it. "Hey, did I hear you say your name just now?" he said. This is one of the many things that Arthur had told the enthusiastic little man. "Yes, it's Arthur Dent." The man seemed to be dancing slightly to some rhythm other than any of the several that the band was grimly pushing out. "Yeah," he said, "only there was a man in a mountain wanted to see you." "I met him." "Yeah, only he seemed pretty anxious about it, you know." "Yes, I met him." "Yeah, well, I think you should know that." "I do, I met him." The man paused to chew a little gum. Then he clapped Arthur on the back. "Okay," he said, "all right, I'm just telling you, right? Good night, good luck, win awards." "What?" said Arthur, who was beginning to flounder seriously at this point. "Whatever, do what you do, do it well." He made a sort of clucking noise with whatever he was chewing, and then some vaguely dynamic gesture. "Why?" said Arthur. "Do it badly," said the man. "Who cares? Who gives a shit?" The blood suddenly seemed to pump angrily into the man's face, and he started to shout. "Why not go mad?" he said. "Go away, get off my back, will you, guy? Just zark off." "Okay, I'm going," said Arthur hurriedly. "It's been real." The man gave a sharp wave and disappeared off into the throng. "What was that about?" said Arthur to a girl he found standing beside him. "Why did you tell me to win awards?" "Just showbiz talk," shrugged the girl. "He's just won an award at the annual Ursa Minor Alpha Recreational Illusions Institute award ceremony, and he was hoping to be able to pass it off lightly, and you didn't mention it, so he couldn't." "Oh," said Arthur. "Oh, well, I'm sorry I didn't. Oh, what was it for?" "The most gratuitous use of the word fuck in a serious screenplay. It's very prestigious." "I see," said Arthur. "Yes, and what do you get for that?" "A Rory. It's just a small silver thing set on a large black base." "What did you say?" "I didn't say anything. I was just about to ask what the silver..." "Oh, I thought you said whoop."
"Said what?"
"Whoop." People had been dropping in on the party now for some years, fashionable gatecrashers from other worlds, and for some time it had occurred to the partygoers as they had looked out at their own world beneath them, with its wrecked cities, its ravaged avocado farms and blighted vineyards, its vast tracts of new desert, its seas full of cracker crumbs and worse, that their world was, in some tiny and almost imperceptible ways, not quite as much fun as it had been. Some of them began to wonder if they could manage to stay sober for long enough to make the entire party space-worthy and maybe take it off to some other people's worlds where the air might be fresher and give them fewer headaches. The few undernourished farmers who still managed to scratch out a feeble existence on the half-dead ground of the planet's surface would have been extremely pleased to hear this. But that day, as the party came screaming out of the clouds and the farmers looked up in haggard fear of yet another cheese and wine raid, it became clear that the party was not going anywhere else for a while, that the party would soon be over. Very soon it would be time to gather up hats and coats and stagger blearily outside to find out what time of day it was, what time of year it was, and whether in any of this burnt and ravaged land there was a taxi going anywhere. The party was locked in a horrible embrace with a strange white spaceship that seemed to be half sticking through it. Together they were lurching, heaving and spinning their way around the sky in grotesque disregard of their own weight. The clouds parted, the air roared and leapt out of their way. The party and the crooked warship looked, in their writhings, a little like two ducks, one of which is trying to make a third duck inside the second duck, while the second duck is trying very hard to explain that it doesn't feel ready for a third duck right now, is uncertain that it would want any putative third duck to be made by this particular first duck anyway, and certainly not while it, the second duck, was busy flying. The sky sang and screamed with the rage of it all, and buffeted the ground with shock waves. And suddenly, with a foop, the cricket ship was gone. The party blundered helplessly across the sky, like a man leaning against an unexpectedly open door. It spun and wobbled on its hover jets. It tried to right itself and wronged itself instead. It staggered back across the sky again. For a while these staggerings continued, but clearly they could not continue for long. The party was now a mortally wounded party. All the fun had gone out of it, as the occasional broken-backed pirouette could not disguise. The longer, at this point, that it avoided the ground, the heavier was going to be the crash, when finally it hit it. Inside, things were not going well either. They were going monstrously badly, in fact, and people were hating it and saying so loudly. The cricket robots had been. They had removed the award for the most gratuitous use of the word fuck in a serious screenplay, and in its place had left a scene of devastation that left Arthur feeling almost as sick as a runner-up for a Rory. "We would love to stay and help," shouted Ford, picking his way over the mangled debris, "only we're not going to." The party lurched again, provoking feverish cries and groans from amongst the smoking wreckage. "We have to go and save the universe, you see," said Ford, "and if that sounds like a pretty lame excuse, then you may be right. Either way, we're off." He suddenly came across an unopened bottle lying miraculously unbroken on the ground. "Do you mind if we take this?" he said. "You won't be needing it." He took a packet of potato crisps as well. "Trillion?" shouted Arthur in a shocked and weakened voice. In the smoking mess he could see nothing. "Earthman, we must go," said Slutty Bartfast nervously. "Trillion!" shouted Arthur again. A moment or two later, Trillion staggered, shaking, into view, supported by her new friend, the Thunder God. "The girl stays with me," said Thor. "There's a great party going on in Valhalla. We'll be flying off." "Where were you when all this was going on?" said Arthur. "Upstairs," said Thor. "I was weighing her. Flying's a tricky business, you see. We have to calculate wind." "She comes with us," said Arthur. "Hey," said Trillion, "don't I..." "No," said Arthur, "you come with us." Thor looked at him with slowly smouldering eyes. He was making some point about godliness, and it had nothing to do with being clean. "She comes with me," he said quietly. "Come on, Earthman," said Slutty Bartfast nervously, picking at Arthur's sleeve. "Come on, Slutty Bartfast," said Ford nervously, picking at the old man's sleeve. Slutty Bartfast had the teleport device. The party lurched and swayed, sending everyone reeling, except for Thor and except for Arthur, who stared, shaking, into the Thunder God's black eyes. Slowly, incredibly, Arthur put up what now appeared to be his tiny little fists. "Want to make something of it?" he said. "I beg your minuscule pardon," roared Thor. "I said," repeated Arthur, and he could not keep the quavering out of his voice, "do you want to make something of it?" He waggled his fists ridiculously. Thor looked at him with incredulity. Then a little wisp of smoke curled upward from his nostrils. There was a tiny little flame in it, too. He gripped his belt. He expanded his chest to make it totally clear that here was the sort of man you only dared to cross if you had a team of Sherpas with you. He unhooked the shaft of his hammer from his belt. He held it up in his hands to reveal a massive iron head. He thus cleared up any possible misunderstanding that he might merely have been carrying a telegraph pole around with him. "Do I want," he said with a hiss like a river flowing through a steel mill, "to make something of it?" "Yes," said Arthur, his voice suddenly and extraordinarily strong and belligerent. He waggled his fists again, this time as if he meant it. "You want to step outside?" he snarled at Thor. "All right," bellowed Thor like an enraged bull, or in fact like an enraged thunder god, which is a great deal more impressive, and did so. "Good," said Arthur. "That's got rid of him. Slutty, get us out of here." Chapter 23. "All right," shouted Ford and Arthur. "So I'm a coward. The point is, I'm still alive." They were back aboard the starship Bistromath. So was Slutty Bartfast. So was Trillion. Harmony and Concord were not. "Well, so I'm alive, aren't I?" retaliated Arthur, haggard with adventure and anger. His eyebrows were leaping up and down as if they wanted to punch each other. "You damn nearly weren't," exploded Ford. Arthur turned sharply to Slutty Bartfast, who was sitting in his pilot couch on the flight deck, gazing thoughtfully into the bottom of a bottle that was telling him something he clearly couldn't fathom. He appealed to him. "Do you think he understands the first word I've been saying?" he said, quivering with emotion. "I don't know," replied Slutty Bartfast a little abstractedly. "I'm not sure," he added, glancing up very briefly, "that I do." He stared at his instruments with renewed vigour and bafflement. "You'll have to explain it to us again," he said. "Well, but later, terrible things are afoot." He tapped the pseudo-glass of the bottle bottom. "We fared rather pathetically at the party, I'm afraid," he said, "and our only hope now is to try and prevent the robots from using the key in the lock. How in heaven we do that, I don't know," he muttered. "Just have to go there, I suppose. Can't say I like the idea at all. Probably end up dead." "Where is Trillion, anyway?" said Arthur with a sudden affectation of unconcern. What he had been angry about was that Ford had berated him for wasting time over all the business with the Thunder God when they could have been making a rather more rapid escape. Arthur's own opinion, and he'd offered it for whatever anybody might have felt it was worth, was that he had been extraordinarily brave and resourceful. The prevailing view seemed to be that his opinion was not worth a pair of fetid dingo's kidneys. What really hurt, though, was that Trillion didn't seem to react much one way or the other, and had wandered off somewhere. "And where are my potato crisps?" said Ford. "They are both," said Slutty Bartfast, without looking up, "in the room of informational illusions. I think that your young lady friend is trying to understand some problems of galactic history. I think the potato crisps are probably helping her." Chapter 24. It is a mistake to think you can solve any major problems just with potatoes. For instance, there was once an insanely aggressive race of people called the Silastic Armor Fiends of Stritorax. that was just the name of their race. The name of their army was something quite horrific. Luckily, they lived even farther back in galactic history than anything we have so far encountered, 20 billion years ago, when the galaxy was young and fresh and every idea worth fighting for was a new one. And fighting was what the Silastic armor fiends of Stryterax were good at. And being good at it, they did it a lot. They fought their enemies, i.e. everybody else. They fought each other. Their planet was a complete wreck. The surface was littered with abandoned cities that were surrounded by abandoned war machines, which were in turn surrounded by deep bunkers in which the Silastic armor fiends lived and squabbled with each other. The best way to pick a fight with the Silastic armor fiend of Stryterax was just to be born. They didn't like it. They got resentful. And when an armor fiend got resentful, someone got hurt. An exhausting way of life, one might think, but they did seem to have an awful lot of energy. The best way of dealing with the Silastic armor fiend was to put him in a room on his own, because sooner or later he would simply beat himself up. Eventually they realized that this is something they were going to have to sort out, and they passed a law decreeing that anyone who had to carry a weapon as part of his normal Silastic work, policemen, security guards, primary school teachers, etc., had to spend at least 45 minutes every day punching a sack of potatoes in order to work off his or her surplus aggression. For a while this worked well, until someone thought it would be much more efficient and less time-consuming if they simply shot the potatoes instead. This led to a renewed enthusiasm for shooting all sorts of things, and they all got very excited at the prospect of their first major war for weeks. Another achievement of the Silastic armor fiends of Stryterax is that they were the first race who ever managed to shock a computer. It was a gigantic spaceborne computer called Haktar, which to this day is remembered as one of the most powerful ever built. It was the first to be built like a natural brain, in that every cellular particle of it carried the pattern of the whole within it, which enabled it to think more flexibly and imaginatively, and also, it seemed, to be shocked. The Silastic armor fiends of Stryterax were engaged in one of their regular wars with the strenuous garfighters of Stug, and were not enjoying it as much as usual, because it involved an awful lot of trekking through the radiation swamps of Qualzenda and across the fire mountains of Frasfraga, neither of which terrains they felt at home in. So when the Strangulus Stiletans of Jajazikstak joined in the fray and forced them to fight another front in the Gamma Caves of Carfrax and the ice storms of Valanguten, they decided that enough was enough, and they ordered Haktar to design for them an ultimate weapon. "What do you mean?" asked Haktar, "by ultimate." To which the Silastic armor fiends of Stryterax said, "Read a bloody dictionary," and plunged back into the fray. So Haktar designed an ultimate weapon. It was a very, very small bomb that was simply a junction box in hyperspace which would, when activated, connect the heart of every major sun with the heart of every other major sun simultaneously, and thus turn the entire universe into one gigantic hyperspatial supernova.